This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, January 13th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker.
You know, for the right to vote and to have that vote counted is democracy's threshold liberty. Without it, nothing is possible. But with it, anything is possible. While the denial of fair and free elections is undemocratic, it is not unprecedented. Black Americans were denied full citizenship voting rights until 1965. Women were denied the right to vote just 100 years ago. The United States Supreme Court in recent years has weakened the Voting Rights Act. And now, the defeated former president and his supporters use the big lie about the 2020 election to fuel torment and anti-voting laws. New laws designed to suppress your vote to subvert our elections.
On Tuesday, President Biden and Vice President Harris traveled to Atlanta for a series of speeches about the administration's renewed commitment to strengthening voting rights. Just days before Martin Luther King Day, they visited civil rights landmarks and re-emphasized the urgency for federal legislation to ensure voter protections. Since the 2020 election, 19 states have passed laws to restrict access to voting. Two bills currently before Congress could overturn some of those laws, but both of them face united opposition from Republicans, and not every Democrat is on board. Jelani Cobb, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss Biden's and Harris's visit to Georgia and how Martin Luther King Jr. can help us understand the current fragile state of our democracy. Hi, Jelani. Welcome back.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I'm well, and I hope you are too. I want to begin by asking you about a speech that King delivered on March 25th, 1965, after the march from Selma to Montgomery. You wrote about it last week for The New Yorker, and maybe you could tell us what he said and why you find it so revelatory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really interesting speech, and when we talk about it, you'll see why. It's one of Reverend William Barber's favorite speeches of Dr. King's. And this is the speech at the culmination of the Selma to Montgomery march in the midst of a really furious campaign for voting rights legislation that ultimately culminates in the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And so Dr. King, you know, who gives this speech just outside the grounds of the state capitol in Alabama, which is really, you know, in the lion's mouth, you know, so to speak, he gives this speech about the importance of the vote and so on. And you kind of anticipate him talking about the need to shore up American democracy and to extend the freedoms of democracy to the whole populace. And these things that were kind of almost boilerplate for civil rights speeches at that time. But he takes a very different tack. And he cites the historian C. Van Woodward and goes back into the origins of the movement to strip the right to vote away from Black people after the Civil War and what its objectives were in the first place. And he presents this argument, which becomes much more prominent in his thinking in the remaining 3 years of his life. But he says that in order to impose a set of policies that would disadvantage everyone across racial lines, all poor people, that the key to doing this was to eliminate Black voters from contention. And he made this argument, in essence, saying that everyone suffered as a result of Black people being denied the ballot. And certainly everyone who was struggling economically suffered as a consequence of this movement and the success of this movement. And so looking at that, I thought it was really notable, the resonances of that speech for the moment we're in right now, especially given that President Biden and Vice President Harris are themselves now knee-deep in a campaign to shore up and extend voting rights yet again.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. One of the things the speech points out is just how radical a thinker he was for his time. Mm. And I just was struck by this notion of the hyper-exploited class of Black people and white elites using that to hold down the wages of white workers. And then the way mm-hmm. King saw it as a kind of interracial populism and how to mm-hmm. correct that way of thinking.
Yeah, I think it was really, you know, a little known speech that should get much more attention. And especially when we think about what's on the table now, when we look at the sorts of things about healthcare, about family leave, about policies that are broadly popular with lots of working people, lots of people who are struggling right now, especially in the COVID economy. And one of the main obstacles standing in the way of that is the likelihood that many people will face obstacles going to the ballot box. And unlike Dr. King's time, where he was talking about the Deep South and specifically African-Americans who are being disenfranchised, we now see this as a much broader question. We're seeing Native American groups and Latino groups and groups that advocate for immigrants, you know, all seeing potential chilling effects from the kind of legislation that's been passed in the last several years.
So King made that speech more than half a century ago. And, you know, when you step back, he was urging us to honestly take stock of our history and then join together to address some of these egregious injustices. And today, as you point out, that school curricula and online discourse are threatening to narrow, not broaden, our understanding both of the past and of the future. And I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on that.
Sure. You know, I think one of the things that was notable to me about King is that when we look at the nuances of his thinking, you know, it's informed not only by theology, but a deep regard for history. And, you know, he cites historians, he makes reference to historical events as a kind of basis of his understanding of civil rights time and again. It's a prominent theme in his thinking. And it's notable to me that these are exactly the areas of history that are now effectively being patrolled and in some instances outlawed from being discussed in our public schools. In, you know, Oklahoma, there are bills that are trying to restrict what can be on the shelves of public libraries. So it's beyond simply what's happening in public schools. And, you know, this kind of gerrymandering of history, such that we have access to the parts that are only complementary to us, but none of the difficult parts, leaves us at a historical disadvantage, at a contemporary disadvantage, because we can't understand our weaknesses. And I thought that that was just jarring in looking at, you know, this is almost a kind of inversion of the very things that King was trying to do in 1965.
And then going back to what Biden has to address right now, this is a low point for the administration. He's had to put on hold his Build Back Better agenda. Omicron continues to surge, and voters are worried about inflation. So the presidential and vice presidential visit to Georgia was intended to deliver a forceful message to the country about protecting our democracy and putting him out there and putting Kamala Harris out there in a way that they haven't been, at least until last week when he delivered his January 6th anniversary address at the Capitol.
More than 55 years ago, men, women, and children marched from Selma to Montgomery to demand the ballot. And when they arrived at the state capitol in Alabama, Dr. King decried what he called normalcy. The normalcy, the complacency that was denying people the freedom to vote. The only normalcy anyone should accept, Dr. King said, is the normalcy of justice. And his words resonate today.
What did you think, Jelani, of Kamala Harris's speech? She had asked for voting rights to be part of her portfolio. Can you see her stamp on the moves the administration has made recently?
Well, yes and no. And I'll say really for both of them, you know, these were great but strange speeches. And, you know, the reason I say that is that the reception that they received in Atlanta was polite. I mean, it is Atlanta, and they pride themselves on being polite there, but it was not really enthusiastic. There were very many prominent people who were in the voting rights movement and activists there who are by and large responsible for their ability to win Georgia, the Biden-Harris ticket in 2020, people who were by and large responsible for their ability to win Georgia who did not show up at those speeches. And so there's been a kind of cold shoulder effect precisely because people believe that voting rights has been placed on the back burner. And so Kamala Harris was there to try to counter that perception, as was the fact that they traveled to John Lewis's congressional district, you know, which covered most of Atlanta, and spoke at the Atlanta University Center, which is home to Morehouse College, where Martin Luther King did his undergraduate studies. So there are all these resonances, but they were really effectively saying not much that the crowd there didn't already know. And so it left a kind of curious after effect of, like, where do we go from here? That was an unintentional quotation of Dr. King's last book.
Yeah, and the effect seems to have been that they were trying to win back the black vote, you know, a little belatedly. So there was that problem. And then there was some criticism that maybe he made the wrong step when Biden, you know, asked whether elected officials wanted to be on the side of Dr. King or George Wallace, of John Lewis or Bull Connor, Abraham Lincoln or Jefferson Davis. So that moment has received a lot of criticism. And I wondered whether you thought, did you think it was an effective or counterproductive rhetorical strategy, given the divisions we're seeing in the country right now?
I know that people really took offense, and you know, Mitt Romney, who people have thought was the last gasp of moderate Republicanism, really thought, you know, this was a kind of sour note, and he said that Biden was not holding true to his promise to unite the country, et cetera. But the fact of it is that he really was not engaging in hyperbole. The forces that were attempting to deny the right to vote or make it more complicated and difficult for people to have access to the ballot were exactly the reactionary forces that President Biden was implicitly comparing people to. And politically speaking, I don't know that their comparison could make things much more difficult than they already are. We have an intransigent, well, we've talked about there being two members of the Senate in particular, Manchin and Sinema, who are intransigent about not wanting to move on the filibuster, which would allow this voting rights legislation to get through the Senate. But the more damning reality is that they are the front people for other Democrats who may not be on board with changing the filibuster either. And so we could talk about it. I think it struck a note. It got people's attention. But I don't think it made things much more difficult for him than they already are.
And you mentioned that you thought it was an effective speech overall. Maybe elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, I mean, I think it was a good speech. When I thought about, you know, the rhetoric that was there and the comparison that was there and Biden talking about connecting this to January 6th and talking about using, again, that incredibly visual image, jarring image of the knife being held to the throat of democracy. And, you know, I think that from the rhetorical standpoint, it was fine. But again, after one of the best, I think, indicators or barometers of how it was received was that afterward, Derek Johnson, who is the president of the NAACP, replied that he thought it was a great speech and now it was time for actions to match words, which is pretty much where I think a lot of the more activist critics or at least skeptics of the administration have been.
So does that hold true for Stacey Abrams? You know, you mentioned people who were quite obviously not there, and she recently announced that she's running again to be Georgia's governor, and she is one of the country's most recognizable voices in the fight for voter protection. So it was striking that she didn't appear.
Yeah, it was very notable that she wasn't there, and you know, the president dismissed this as a conflict of schedules. Certainly, Stacey Abrams didn't put out a statement saying that she was avoiding it out of principle, but the fact of the matter is that when the president wants something, people tend to be able to change their schedules to accommodate him. And for that matter, the activist groups, you know, Black Voters Matter and the other people who've been on the ground in Georgia who have really done the groundwork and the grassroots organizing that created this electorate, that has now delivered Georgia to the Harris-Biden ticket, that those people were not happy with the administration. And just pragmatically, I think a lot of people have thought about Stacey Abrams in lots of different ways in terms of how to categorize her politically. But she is a profoundly pragmatic person. Now, she describes herself as a pragmatic progressive. And so the pragmatic move here was not to cross those groups that have been so key to the recent developments in Georgia politics.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So I'm wondering what Biden can do right now politically. As you mentioned, the Democrats' two bills before Congress, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, are designed to bolster voter protections, particularly in the face of all these restrictions we're seeing that have been recently passed in some Republican states. But Republicans in the Senate, completely predictably, have blocked both bills. And if there's any hope for either of them, the filibuster rule is going to have to be changed. And that seems unlikely. So what can Biden do?
I mean, it's a real question. You know, I think that people are wondering if there's something that he can do in terms of applying pressure. They've tried, you know, various combinations of sticks and carrots, and there hasn't been much that has moved people on this. And so I don't really know, you know, what's in his portfolio to be able to address this. But one of the other things that I think is crucial in terms of pointing out the stakes here is that any hope of Democrats holding on to the Senate or the House, for that matter, it will be contingent upon this legislation making it through. And any hope of avoiding a potentially cataclysmic election in 2024, in which we could very well see secretaries of state or state legislatures reversing the votes of their population. The only thing that we're thinking about that could prevent that is federal legislation, and that is right now being held up. One of the more notable things I think about this is that Joe Manchin has said that he will not support legislation that's not bipartisan, but his own attempt to craft bipartisan voting legislation went nowhere with Republicans. And so if Joe Manchin can't float something that they're willing to sign on to, then there's very little hope that anyone can. And so that's where things stand.
Well, and Biden himself, you know, who prides himself on his ability to craft deals across the aisle, is just, you know, obviously completely exasperated at this point. I guess he had great confidence that he and his old friend, Joe Manchin, could work things out.
Yeah, I think it's almost a kind of barometer of the difference between Biden's era in the Senate and the current era in the Senate, that there is no bigger reward than there is for obstruction, that the parties that are in the minority have really no incentive to craft anything that will allow anything to happen in the Senate. And so it is just kind of a matter of you either have power or you hold on to the ball and run down the clock until you can get power again. And so for all the geniality and the charm and the arm twisting and backdoor cigar smoking that can happen in the Senate chambers, it's not likely to make much of a difference right now, at least the way things look.
So Martin Luther King Day is on Monday. His family, led by his eldest son, Martin Luther King III will lead a march across the Frederick Douglass Memorial Bridge in Washington before joining the annual Memorial Peace Walk. And he said in a statement, "We're directly calling on Congress not to pay lip service to my father's ideals without doing the very thing that would protect his legacy, pass voting rights legislation." But, you know, there we go again. You know, are there other means to ensure that our democracy survives? Can we look to the courts? Given the impasse in Congress, what else can be done?
Yeah, I mean, I think that people are increasingly talking about this, that there may be rulings, federal court rulings, that affect some of this. And, you know, that's possible. But I think that the scale of the problem is such that you really do need a legislative solution. When we look at the Freedom to Vote Act and what's in there, it really is a kind of grab bag, you know, making Election Day a holiday so that people have access to vote, ensuring that people have at least 2 weeks of early voting, standardizing procedures in order to protect, you know, voting machines and machinery, automatic voter registration so that now I think it's 19 states or so that have automatic voter registration. This would extend that throughout the country. And we've seen in the aftermath of the 2020 election a number of statewide audits of the presidential ballots. And this has a mechanism that would provide for bipartisan or nonpartisan audits of statewide elections, which in theory is something that would allow Republicans to sign on to this legislation. Obviously, in the climate that we're seeing right now, that's not something that's going to happen, or at least has not happened thus far. And so the federal courts, possibly, but I think that the real solution here is going to require something legislative.
And there's also activism. And I really liked a line in your piece about the intransigent optimism that led activists to fight for change in the face of skepticism about what could actually be achieved. And then as King put it in the speech, "We must come to see that the end we seek is a society at peace with itself, a society that can live with its conscience." So any parting thoughts about what needs to be addressed on this holiday and in the years ahead?
Well, I think that unfortunately, what we're seeing is an alignment of the stars in such a way that it recreates the impetus for people like Dr. King in the first place. One of the things that we have tended to do in our society because of our particular approaches around history is that we've seen a pot that's been on the stove about to boil over, and we wisely figure out that we have to remove that pot from the burner. And then a few years later, we don't realize the relationship between heat and boiling, and we put the pot back on the boiler and go through the same cycle again. Mm-hmm. And it seems that we're in that place. And, you know, we are inspiring new generations of activism, new generations of voices and people who are speaking out on behalf of these issues. And we will likely see this become much more of a central issue, if not the central issue, in our politics in coming years.
Thanks so much, Jelani. Jelani Cobb is a staff writer at The New Yorker, a professor of journalism at Columbia University, and the author of The Substance of Hope, Barack Obama and the Paradox of Progress. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron, Kylie Warner, and Michelle Moses for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.